Good morning, everyone. I'm Craig McClure, IAS Executive Director, and welcome to today's plenary press briefing. I think we had a second really exciting plenary session today. I'm really looking forward to turning over to the three plenary presentations in a minute. Just a couple of quick remarks. Again, please silence your phones to avoid any feedback with the microphones. A couple of highlights for today to make you aware of. At 1 o'clock, we're hosting a special session in the Bayside Auditorium B, which is about the future of global financing of HIV prevention, treatment, care, and research. It's a particularly important issue at a time when the Sydney Declaration is calling for countries, donors, and governments to allocate 10% of all of their resources to ensure that research, all kinds of research, operations, evaluation, cost-effectiveness research, as well as clinical research, are done to both build health systems in countries and ensure a stronger future for HIV prevention and treatment and care. That session will be chaired by IAS President Pedro Kahn and the Australian AIDS Ambassador Anne-Marie O'Keefe, and include Michelle Kazachkine and Deborah Work-Zudi from the World Bank, AIDS Ambassador Paul Beckers from the Netherlands, and Judy Auerbach on research. So several other sessions today look at pediatric transmission, diagnosis and management, female-controlled prevention technologies, and the HIV-TB pandemic. And today at 12:30, a major new international initiative is being launched to support research, prevention, and treatment and care for gay men and other men who have sex with men in developing countries, I think a critical issue. And MFAR Treat Asia is launching that international initiative at a press conference at 12:30. I'd like to introduce now the first plenary speaker from this morning, Professor Robert Bailey, who's really devoted most of his research activities in the last 12 years to the issue of male circumcision as a possible HIV prevention strategy. I think Dr. Bailey laid to rest this morning whether it is a potential strategy or not. It is a strategy in HIV prevention. Dr. Bailey is professor of epidemiology at the School of Public Health, University of Illinois at Chicago, and a research associate at the Field Museum in Chicago. Dr. Bailey?
Thank you, Craig. I understand I'm supposed to just give a 2-minute summary of what we discussed this morning. I'd just say that male circumcision is probably the oldest surgical procedure in humans. It's been around for at least 4,500 years. And for many years, people looked at the distribution of HIV prevalence around the globe, and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, and wondered why there were such huge disparities in prevalence across countries. So, for example, in West Africa, in a country like Cameroon or Nigeria, where all the same conditions exist for a rampant epidemic similar to Zimbabwe or Botswana or Swaziland, and yet in West African countries, Cameroon, Nigeria, the HIV prevalence has never risen above 6 or 7%. And so it was actually in 1995 that someone noticed that actually all the areas where HIV prevalence is the highest are just those regions and those communities where circumcision is not traditionally practiced, and that in the lower HIV prevalent countries, circumcision is almost universal. So that got people initially looking into this. And in any case, many observational studies then found this association between circumcision and HIV infection, but it was really the results of 3 randomized control trials, which have now been completed. The last 2 were stopped actually early because they showed such a high degree of efficacy that it wouldn't be then ethical to continue the trial and withhold circumcision from the control group. So those trials have shown overall about a 60% protective effect of circumcision against HIV acquisition in heterosexual men in Africa. So I think if we had a vaccine that was 60% protective, that we would be very happy, and we would be rolling it out as fast as we can. So now we get to the point where we do have this very effective or efficacious HIV prevention strategy, and it's now time to move from the research, which has shown the efficacy, to now policy and implementation of the intervention. So the challenge that's ahead of us is actually how to roll out circumcision safely and make it widespread in a way that is ethically non-discriminatory against those who do or do not circumcise, and also to persuade leaders in countries that it is going to help their populations. So I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bailey. Our second plenary presenter this morning is Dr. John Rossi, who's professor and chair of the Division of Molecular Biology and dean of the Graduate School of Biological Sciences at City of Hope's Beckman Research Institute. Dr. Rossi spoke this morning about cutting-edge research and the use of gene therapy as a potential HIV treatment strategy. He and his lab have made exciting early developments in this area that have now moved into human trials. Dr. Rossi.
Thank you. About 20 years ago, David Baltimore, who is a Nobel laureate, discovered one of the co-discoverers of reverse transcriptase, coined the term intracellular immunity to describe a possible mechanism for making our own cells immune to viral infections. And basically, this is the approach that we've chosen to take, that is to genetically engineer human T cells, and in our case, actually human blood stem cells, with genes that would protect the T cells or the progeny cells from the stem cells against HIV infection. And we chose to take this approach, I would say, in the early 1990s at the City of Hope, because the City of Hope is actually one of the world's leading bone marrow transplant institutions. We transplant approximately 500 patients a year, so there's a lot of expertise there. And we realized that this is not a treatment that's going to be applied universally, but we do believe that the principle of intracellular immunity is something that can be applied more widely, given that we can prove that it really works. And so our approach has been to take both blood stem cells as well as T cells out of patients that are HIV infected and introduce into these cells genes that would then produce products that would inhibit HIV replication. And this would be long term. This is a permanent modification of these cells, so that as long as these cells persist in the patient, they will have resistance to HIV infection, with the goal that there would be a reduced viral load in these patients, and that eventually you could either control the virus by this approach alone, or at least use this approach in combination with conventional drug therapy, highly active antiretroviral therapy, but reducing the doses of the drugs in order to improve the lives of patients. And so this is something that we really are very keen on initiating, and we've been very fortunate to be able to get through all of the hurdles that it takes to get to this point. And as I stated in my talk, we are now in the position to enroll our first patient, and we've already enrolled the first patient. This patient will be infused with his own blood stem cells that have been genetically modified, and we will enroll four more patients after him. Hopefully, we'll be able to follow these patients long term. We'll be looking at their viral loads. We'll be looking at the marking of their blood cells with our introduced genes, and we'll be looking at a number of other factors. So it's a landmark trial in many ways, and we're really very interested and excited about the ability to be able to be the first people in the world to do this.
Thank you, Dr. Rossi. As you've heard, there's been exciting advances all week across the three tracks of the conference. Some of the most important news coming out of Sydney is in relation to treatment advances in the clinical track. Important information on new drugs and existing classes of antiretrovirals, as well as entirely new classes of antiretrovirals that rely on novel mechanisms of action. Dr. Joseph Eron is a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Medicine. as a third plenary presenter this morning, he gave us an overview and update on these new treatment strategies. I turn to you now, Dr. Ehring.
Sure. Just briefly, I think it's exciting and fortunate that there's still very active interest in developing new compounds in HIV. We have over 20 licensed drugs, and yet the enthusiasm of investigators and companies has really, I think, been terrific in terms of developing new drugs and new strategies, like Dr. Rossi mentioned. And it's a particularly exciting time, and maybe even a transforming time, because we have so many new agents coming available at almost the same time. We have the new classes that Craig mentioned, the integrase inhibitors and the CCR5 inhibitors that work by blocking the virus entry into the cell. And then we also have kind of second-generation drugs, some of which I didn't talk about, these protease inhibitors, and some which I did, the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. And I really think that the opportunity for even our most treatment-experienced patients to become fully suppressed, to get their viral load to these undetectable levels, I think this opportunity is now on hand, even for our most experienced patients. And I think the hope, too, is that some of these new drugs might help people that are newly diagnosed. Some are infected with resistant virus, both in the developed and the developing world. And I think, though I'm sure it will take more time, some of these new agents will also be very useful in the developing world, where we're seeing the emergence of resistant virus. And as we heard, these countries really need additional strategies, additional drugs to treat their patients.
Thank you, Dr. Ehring. I think we'll open up for questions now. If you want to just remember to state your name and your media organization before you start.
Tamar Khan, Business Day, South Africa. It's a question to Robert Bailey. I was just wondering, you expressed a degree perhaps of impatience that fewer countries are, that people are moving slowly with regards to implementing or devising policies on circumcision and implementing them. I just wondered whether there are signs of progress and whether there are some places where things are moving in the direction that you would like to see. And where there isn't, what to your mind is holding progress back? Why are some countries so slow to even begin talking about developing a policy? And I'm thinking of some of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa, such as South Africa, which are particularly hard hit by HIV.
Yeah, well, there are several small programs where people are providing circumcision services and trying to do it in concert with voluntary counseling and testing but by and large, now that the International Health Normative Agency WHO and UNAIDS has made a statement endorsing circumcision, the next step is to get the leaders of countries to actually come up with policy statements endorsing the practice. And as you know, circumcision, you know, is not just simply a medical procedure. It's tied up in a complex web of cultural and religious practices and beliefs. And so I think, it's not easy for politicians and ministries of health, et cetera, to just very quickly come out in favor of circumcision in countries where circumcision is not traditionally practiced. So it's going to take some time, and I think it's really, now really in the lap of the leaders to show some leadership and to actually see that this is going to have tremendous benefits for the people in their countries. And to actually endorse it. Until it's endorsed by local communities and governments, it's going to be difficult to get donors to come in and endorse and support circumcision services, because you know they don't want to be seen as imposing their culture and their values on indigenous cultures and governments. So, you know, it's going to be very important to get the policymakers within the countries to step up.
Dr. Bailey, just a quick follow-up. You talked in your talk about the important role that women can play in communities where male circumcision is not practiced. Could you just say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, we've done a lot of studies of interviewing men and women, both in focus groups and individual interviews. And what we find is that women actually, even more than men, equate circumcision with improved hygiene. And many of them complain that actually the men in their communities are not as clean as they could be. It's often up to women to provide the water, the soap, and materials for men to bathe and to clean themselves, and the women complain that the men don't take advantage of these services. So I think women, wherever we've done studies in Uganda, Kenya, Malawi, and Zambia, and everywhere, women often are the ones who are in most favor of circumcision as a means to better cleanliness, and thereby men carrying fewer diseases, namely STIs and HIV. So I think that women are going to be very important, plus, of course, as mothers. And as mothers, they believe that child and infant circumcision actually would be preferable because it's less painful. It's easier for them to care for the wound. They can control the child. And so even though infant circumcision is little known in East and Southern Africa, I think mothers are going to be major drivers in pushing male circumcision forward in many of these communities.
Thank you. Okay, next question.
It's Lee Dayton. I'm with The Australian, which is our national newspaper here. My question is for Dr. Rossi. Could you tell us a little bit more about the protocol that you've got in place, timelines, and sex of the people that are involved, and how you see following up that initial preliminary, which I assume is an efficacy trial? And then secondly, could you explain a little bit more in detail how this could be rolled out into the and more widely applied? Okay. And then may I get a second question after, or do I stand in line?
Is it an entirely separate,
it's
unrelated
entirely
question?
Entirely separate. I'll
then
stand
we'll give
in
someone
line.
Else a yeah. chance, and hopefully you'll get another chance before we finish.
So there are two separate trials that we're planning using the same vector to deliver these anti-HIV genes. And the first trial, which is already initiated, is to use what we say is an autologous stem cell approach, that is, patients give up their own stem cells, which are then genetically modified. And it's open to all AIDS lymphoma patients that have had lymphoma but have had a successful treatment of that lymphoma in the first course. These patients have to have certain other criteria. They have to be responsive to the antiretroviral drug therapy. They also have to have CD4 counts of 200 or higher. And as I said, they have to be responsive to the antiretroviral drug therapy. That means their viral loads have to be below 500. It's open to men and women, and AIDS-related lymphoma has actually decreased significantly since the heart era. But the percentage of HIV-infected individuals that come down with AIDS-related lymphoma is the same. It hasn't changed over the years. It's just the absolute numbers are down. So, but the reason for choosing this population is that they will benefit from a stem cell transplant. Now, why do we want to do a stem cell transplant? We really don't know how much engraftment of stem cells we would have if we didn't prepare the marrow for the stem cells to go back into. So if we were to just take stem cells from anybody in this room, which we could do, and genetically modify them and put them back into the patient, the chances are that those stem cells would not engraft, we don't believe, because there's no space created in the marrow. Now, this is the extreme setting where you completely ablate the marrow and the stem cells now will go back and the entire marrow will be reconstituted by these stem cells that have been genetically modified, plus they get unmodified cells at the same time. But the hope for the long term is that you could use a single ablating agent.
Yeah. Hematopoietic cells.
Yeah, hematopoietic cells, right. You could use a single agent that would create a little space in the marrow by killing off some of the resident cells, allowing then room for engraftment. And this would be an outpatient procedure. So this could be expanded to a much larger patient population. And that would be the next step in the process. So the first step is to make sure that these three genes are not going to have any negative effect on the patients. They're going to be positive in terms of knocking down viral infection and that the hematopoietic system will reconstitute normally. Once we get through those five patients, then we seriously will look into going into a more modified approach where we don't have to go through the extreme of a bone marrow transplant, but just what we call a stem cell transplant without chemo or without
any...
You just insert them into the peripheral circulation, so it's just an injection. And that's the way it's being done for this approach as well. So they're not actually getting them infused into the marrow. They go right into their peripheral circulation, but the cells will migrate to the marrow because of growth factors that are being secreted by the marrow stromal cells.
So that makes it clear that the second part of my question is it would be used in conjunction with drug therapy.
Yes, correct. Yes.
Hopefully you two can connect after for a more in-depth interview. Let's take another question.
Hi, Dr. Bailey. Your announcement of the readiness to roll out circumcision policy will no doubt create ripples, and in a positive way. My question is, as one of them, is it likely that the focus for this emerging policy will be on in areas where currently there are very high infection rates? And two, any timeline for this policy? And with, as you mentioned, interestingly, with regards to the whole issue of the how easy it will be, how much easier it will be to deal with circumcision at birth, are there any considerations being given to incorporating circumcision as part of an immediate antenatal procedure, particularly in countries where there are no religious or other restrictions? Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I'm Andrea Downer from the Gina Company in Jamaica.
Thank you.
I mean, where circumcision is going to be most effective is in countries that have the highest HIV prevalence, and those are the countries, at least in sub-Saharan Africa, where most men are not circumcised. So many non-circumcising communities in Africa have very high rates of HIV, and so introducing circumcision services is going to be effective there. In terms of timeline, it's you know, in our acceptability studies, we've seen that many men, particularly younger men, really would prefer to be circumcised in these non-circumcising communities. On the ground, people are ready for the services. People come to clinics now asking for circumcision, but the funding is not available yet, and so those services largely are not available, or if they are, they're being provided by unqualified practitioners who simply don't have the proper equipment, they don't have the proper training, and there are lots of adverse events that are ensuing. So we actually have data from various communities where the adverse event rates are 25 to 35% among these unqualified practitioners, whereas in our trials the adverse event rates were only 1.5 to 3%. So actually delaying rollout of circumcision could be causing more harm, not just because more people are getting infected than necessary with HIV, but also because people are going for circumcision to unqualified practitioners. In terms of neonatal circumcision, I think there isn't a tradition of neonatal circumcision in East and Southern Africa. It's more common in West Africa, certainly, you know, it's very common in the United States. So it's unlikely that there's going to be a large initial rush for neonatal circumcision. But it's thought that over time, as circumcision gets more widely accepted and more widely available, that particularly through the impetus of mothers, it's likely that the age of circumcision will probably decline, and that eventually infant circumcision may become quite acceptable in some of these communities. And it's probable that neonatal circumcision, we've proven that adult circumcision is effective, so it certainly would be the case that neonatal circumcision would be efficacious in reducing HIV acquisition, and it could be even more efficacious than adult circumcision.
Next question.
Good morning. My name is Cedrian Martin. I'm from the Trinidad Express newspaper. Dr. Bailey, this morning you questioned whether we should consider lowering the threshold of evidence required to move toward implementation. And I'm wondering if you would expand on that. Isn't it better to have waited these last 6 years to be certain that it would be effective, that it would be safe?
Yeah, I think circumcision may be different than other possible interventions. So, I mean, it remains to be seen, for example, you know, for many years there have been, you know, attempts at developing microbicides, particularly for women. We need a microbicide because women need to have some degree of control, and as it is now, they're highly vulnerable, and so a microbicide could actually really benefit women tremendously. So it could be that if we get a microbicide that proves to be effective, that only one clinical trial is going to be necessary to sort of tip the balance in favor of rolling out or providing the microbicide widely. Circumcision may be unique in that, as I said, it's bound in this complex web of culture and religion. It's not just a, you know, a health-related intervention. It is, but, you know, so I hope the threshold will not be so strict for some future interventions, which really could have a tremendous benefit. I mean, it's been 24 years since the first person found that circumcision was associated with lack of associated with HIV. And so it's been a really long haul. I think, you know, it's because, you know, it's the penis after all. So it's not that easy to accept that kind of intervention.
I'd like to have a question for Dr. Eirin. Sherry, is yours for Dr. Eirin?
No, it's a question for Dr. Bailey, and it's about rollout of this program.
Okay. Can we have one question for Dr. Eirin, and then we'll go back to Sherry?
Thank you.
Mine? Was your question for Dr. Eirin? No. Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry to butt in, but if you could give us an example. Oh, sorry.
If you could give us an example of a drug that you think is just now starting to really, or drug or a therapy, class of drug or treatment that you think is just now starting to become increasingly effective, and what do you predict is going to be the most likely class of particularly useful drugs down the line? What's the cutting edge on this?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. I think that the integrase inhibitors, which I spent some time on this morning, are, I think, particularly attractive because it's targeting an HIV enzyme. And the drugs that we have to date, right, are the reverse transcriptase inhibitors and the protease inhibitors, which are also HIV enzymes. So I think we really know how to develop those drugs. We know how to develop them. We know how to, you know, predict resistance to those therapies. So I think that it's conceptually much easier for us to figure out how to use them. And so I can see perhaps the integrase inhibitors expanding most rapidly in terms of use and benefit. On the other hand, the CCR5 inhibitors, those are the drugs that inhibit HIV entry. They're a little more complicated because they're targeting a human target, right? The receptor is actually a human molecule, not an HIV molecule, but you could imagine perhaps that they could be used in prevention. A microbicide was mentioned. It might be a terrific use as a microbicide. So I think that the entry inhibitors, especially the CCR5 inhibitors, might be a little bit more difficult to roll out in a big way for HIV treatment, but may have, you know, novel and very interesting and perhaps even prevention implications. Right, exactly, right.
Sherry.
Good morning. Thank you all. Sherry Margulies from Voices of Positive Women in Toronto, Canada. Dr. Bailey, I'd like to ask you, I read the WHO guidance document on male circumcision and the rollout, and of course we know that there's a very small sentence on the second page about the fact that this is not going to be a prevention intervention for women. What my question is to you is, what type of counseling and so on are you providing? Are you including women in developing some of that? And the reason I pose this is, having been in Nairobi recently with the World YWCA, women there from Africa are highly, highly concerned that their partners will now use this as an excuse not to wear condoms and possibly become more
more sexually active than ever with other partners, and that they are putting themselves at greater risk. And I'd like to hear your comments on that. And the second part of it, which is part of this as well, is when the men are coming in and looking for the circumcision and the services are not provided, are they giving you any indication of, oh, this is great, I don't have to wrap it up? Those types of, I don't have to wear a condom, is this going to, are they looking at it as another excuse, basically? Thank you.
Yeah, very good questions. It's true this is not directly applicable for women, obviously. But, you know, if we can reduce prevalence in men, that's clearly going to have an effect on women. The fewer men that are infected, the fewer women are going to become infected. So it's possible in modeling to actually factor in the effect on women's prevalence, and we can see that after about 5 or 6 years, as you see declines in prevalence in men, you're going to see also then decline in prevalence in women. But it's true, it's yet another male-controlled prevention strategy, and we need more prevention strategies for that women can control. The concern about men using as an excuse not to wear a condom, I mean, that's why it's very important not to view this as a standalone surgical procedure, that when we provide the services, they must be provided in concert with intensive counseling, both to caution men against it being protective. We have to get across that concept of partial protection. And that's going to be challenging. In fact, it doesn't really change any messages that we give to individual men. It changes, we can provide communication strategies at the community level, talking about the effectiveness of circumcision and how it's going to be good for the community. It's a good public health measure that's going to reduce HIV prevalence in the community. But at the individual level, we still have to counsel men exactly the same way about practicing safe sexual behaviors, about wearing a condom, about being faithful, about getting tested. All the same messages should be there, and at the individual level, they won't change. But instead of seeing it, you know, as I said this morning, instead of seeing it as a challenge, it really is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to engage men. Young men often don't report to health facilities. They're not accessible, you know, to health providers. And so this is an opportunity to access a subpopulation that is difficult to access, and then also to engage their partners. So to actually make it part of family planning, of couples counseling, to actually talk to women about the efficacy of circumcision, and you know how to communicate with their partners about it. So I think that ultimately, if we do it right, it's going to drop prevalence not just because of the biological effect of circumcision, but also because we have these opportunities to access people that often are high risk and vulnerable, and that we can, you know, bolster our prevention efforts in other ways besides just the surgical procedure.
Kenya?
My question is for Dr. Bailey. I'm Kanya Ndaki from Erin News in South Africa. Some of the research questions you mentioned, which are unanswered, are the protective effects on women and also on men who have sex with men. I wanted to find out how far along we are in finding out the answers to these questions.
Yeah, I didn't really have a chance to talk about that. There is the trial in Rakai, Uganda, has enrolled discordant couples in which the man is HIV infected and the woman is HIV negative, and they have randomized the men then to be circumcised or to remain uncircumcised. Unfortunately, enrollment in that trial was stopped prematurely, because it was found in preliminary analyses that actually there were a number of infections in the women partners of the circumcised men. And what seemed to be happening was that actually the HIV-positive men who got circumcised started sexual activity early, before the wound was fully healed. And so there were a number of seroconversions in their female partners. So they stopped enrollment, but the DSMB is now reanalyzing the data, and that trial may resume. In terms of men who have sex with men, it's not really clear, I mean, plausibly, biologically, that if circumcision does have a protective effect on men, that among men who have sex with men who are just tops, that is, who don't practice receptive anal sex, but only insertive sex, it could be an advantage to them. So there are some beginning efforts to design trials among men who have sex with men. And there is one prospective study that's shown a 30% protective effect in men who have sex with men in the United States. So you know, there's some promise there, but it's not yet clear really what effect it's going to have for men who have sex with men.
It's going to be difficult in a control to do a controlled clinical trial in homosexual men, particularly because the benefit would be an insert to those who are infected through insertive anal intercourse, if you mentioned. Wouldn't it be better to do an effectiveness trial in a community where you offer men who aren't circumcised circumcision and then monitor them over time over a bigger population? It seems to me a controlled clinical trial is not going to get off the ground or answer this question. And in the meantime, as you mentioned, communities, both in developing and developed countries, homosexual men are wanting answers as to whether this intervention could protect them as well.
Yeah, well, as you know, community trials are very difficult and very expensive, and controlling conditions is difficult. But that's a consideration. I think it could be, though, that actually transmissions, even through receptive anal sex, could be reduced somewhat by circumcision because, as you saw, genital ulcer disease is decreased with circumcision. So there may be less viral shedding among men who are circumcised. So it could work even if men are practicing receptive anal sex, there could be some protective effect of circumcision.
Next question.
I'm Padma from India. My question is for Dr. Iran. These new classes of compounds that you mentioned, in practical terms, when is the first product likely to be available commercially, assuming that the trial results are positive? And what are the cost comparisons like compared to existing known HIV drugs, especially because producing generic versions of these would obviously not be there on the horizon?
Yeah, I can tell you what I know, and the Maraviroc, which is the CCR5 inhibitor, has been submitted both to the FDA in the U.S. and the EMEA in Europe, and the company has gotten favorable opinions from both of those bodies. So it seems likely that, at least in the U.S. and Europe, that Maraviroc, the CCR5 inhibitor, you know, will be approved in, you know, a very short period of time, weeks or months, perhaps. The integrase inhibitor, raltegravir, that's the Merck compound, has been submitted to the FDA in the U.S., and they actually have a date where the FDA advisory will meet. That's September 5th. I think it's also been submitted in Europe, but I'm not certain about that. In terms of pricing, I honestly don't have any idea. You have to ask the individual companies. I think also it's important for all of us, HIV scientists, the WHO, the IAS, to really urge these companies that they have to make these drugs available, not just in markets in the U.S. and Western Europe. And I think the stronger the voice, and the better off we'll be. All of us need to be part of that voice. But I don't know exactly what those plans are, and I wouldn't be truthful if I tried to guess.
Dr. Iran, just on that, you highlighted the critical importance of these new drugs, particularly for women and men who've been treated for many years, who are obviously primarily people in developed countries because it opens up new options to keep them alive and well. What do you think the implications are now of all of these available drugs in terms of first-line regimens for developing countries? As people know, the cheapest first-line regimen and most widely used is D4T3TC nevirapine, which is practically unused at all anymore in developed countries.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that in terms of simplicity and safety, other than the D4T component, which I think the WHO, the IAS, I think agree, other than its low cost, it really is not optimal for first-line therapy or therapy in general. I think the opportunities with these new drugs are, one, the NNRTI, the non-nucleoside drugs, potentially they could be used in settings where it's difficult to use nevirapine and difficult to use efavirenz. We don't know yet, but perhaps they would be more useful in people co-infected with tuberculosis, which is obviously a huge problem in the developing world, in sub-Saharan Africa in particular. To me, I think the real usefulness of these drugs in the developing world setting is in the context of patients who are have their therapy kind of changed and monitored based on clinical parameters. There's a whole session tomorrow, as you know, looking at the utility of clinical monitoring in terms of really predicting virologic failure. And it's really not very accurate. And unfortunately, patients that have persistent viral replication in the face of continued therapy end up with very resistant virus. They don't get broad resistance like we see in the U.S. or Europe, but they get very intensive resistance to the nucleosides, and therefore then their second-line therapies become very limited. So I think that, to me, that's the real opportunity for these new agents in the developing world setting.
We have time for one final question, if there is one.
Daniela from Australia. In terms of prevention technology, some Australian groups of scientists are developing a microbicide as a condom coating. Do you think there's a good application for that in terms of prevention for HIV spreading from male to male and male to women? Or is it better as an applicator, like as a gel that's being applied to women?
Sorry, what is it?
There's a microbicide being a gel being developed as a condom coating. Do you think there is a good use for that as a new preventative technology, or is it better as an applicator, as being a gel applied to a diaphragm, or just applied as a gel for women? You're not really sure what I'm talking about.
I don't know enough about it to really comment.
Well, I think
just because you were talking about
that. Answer this question for sure. I'll start it and then he'll finish it. I think the key thing about a microbicide is that it's a women-controlled prevention. I think, and it might be fine to have a microbicide on the outside of a condom, but if it still relies on a man to put it on, I think it is not as useful as a microbicide that can be used by the women.
We might be able to teach women to put it on the man.
Getting the man to allow it to be put on in the first place.
Just a follow-up question to that, or do you really want to shut down?
We're okay. We got one more minute.
Okay, one more.
But to the microphone, Lynn. To the microphone.
Isn't there some concern developing that the use of microbicides can, in fact, enhance the problem of transmission of the virus because of some sort of likely some sort of internal abrasion?
Good question.
Well, I mean, as you know, we've had two microbicides that have had disappointing results. One showed no effect, and then the other actually showed increased risk of HIV acquisition in women, and the probable mechanism was probably inflammation and perhaps abrasions caused by the compound. Remember, those trials were in sex workers who are applying the compound multiple times daily. Unfortunately, those are often the populations that we need for these trials because we need high incidence to show efficacy. I think the newer microbicides that are in the pipeline are going to hopefully avoid that those problems, and I think there's much more extensive phase one and phase two trial activities to ensure safety and to ensure that these microabrasions aren't going to be caused by these new compounds. So yeah, I think there's a few promising compounds in the pipeline, and we can still be hopeful.
And there is data being presented on that trial. I think it is today sometime. I haven't got it memorized in my head.
Okay. That's tomorrow.
Tomorrow. There's a late breaker session tomorrow from the phase three trial of cellular sulfate, which is the second trial, microbicide trial that showed a negative effect in terms of the abrasion. I think the important thing to remember is that with microbicides, both the active ingredient is different in each one, but so is the vehicle. So just because one fails or two fail doesn't mean that another. Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much for a very interesting press conference.